Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, everyone. Let's get the meeting started. I'd like to all welcome you to the Long Beach City Hall Chambers on behalf of our three sponsoring organizations: the League of Women Voters of Long Beach Area, Common Cause of California, and the Commonwealth Club, and also the Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform Project. My name is Phyllis O'Connor. I'm the president of the Long Beach League of Women Voters. I'm standing in for Kathy Fung, who is on her way from the parking lot as we speak, and she will be here very shortly. She will be our moderator tonight. Kathy is the executive director of California Common Cause. I'd like to introduce our speakers that we have tonight. We have State Senator Alan Lowenthal. He represents this district, the 27th District in Long Beach. He was elected in November of 2004, and he followed 6 years in the California State Assembly. He's chair of the Senate Transportation and Housing, as well as the Transportation and Housing Committee Subcommittee on California Ports and Goods Movement. The senator is committed to protecting the environment through innovative policy solutions and strong stewardship of public lands. He's a resident of Long Beach, married to Dr. Debbie Malumed, a family practice physician. He has two adult sons, one grandson. He graduated with a BA from Hobart College and earned a PhD from Ohio State University. Our next speaker will be Douglas Johnson. He's a consulting fellow for the Rose Institute of State and Local Government at Claremont McKenna College. He is an MBA with the UCLA Anderson Graduate School of Management. He's been involved with the Rose Institute since his college years, since he served as a student manager in 1991 and 92. Mr. Johnson assists with Rose Institute research on redistricting reform, census data use and analysis, and geographic information systems. Other consulting projects Mr. Johnson has worked on include the State of Florida's State Senate Committee on Reapportionment and the State of Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission for Congressional and Legislative Redistricting. Mr. Johnson was a Coro Public Affairs Fellow. He served as legislative director to U.S. Representative Stephen Horn and worked as a project manager for various software companies prior to his return to the Institute in 2001. Our next speaker is Lori Lofstrom. Lori is from the Long Beach Chamber of Commerce. She received her BA in political science from California State University, Northridge, and she earned a JD from Southwestern University School of Law. Ms. Lofstrom began her legal career at the Long Beach offices of Kiesel, Young & Logan, representing large corporations and major brokerage houses in both litigation and transactional matters. With her background in securities and transactional work, Ms. Lofstrom formed Lofstrom Law Corporation, focusing on franchise, intellectual property, and general business transactions. In 2002, she co-founded the firm of Holmes & Lofstrom, expanding the scope of legal services to include corporate, trademark, and both domestic and international franchising. Ms. Lofstrom serves on the board of directors of the Long Beach Chamber of Commerce, its leadership cabinet, and was recently appointed vice chair of public policy and chair of the Chamber's Government Affairs Council. She has served on the board of directors of the Chamber's Women's Business Council and is the first two-term president in that organization's 44-year history. Our next speaker is Stephen Ochoa. He is the director of voting rights and policy research with the William Velasquez Institute. Stephen has served as the Director of Voting Rights and Policy Research for the William C. Velasquez Institute since June of 2006. He recently joined WCVI after receiving his Master of Public Policy from the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan, where he focused on voting and civil rights for minority interests, in particular for the Latino community. A Los Angeles area resident, he earned his bachelor's degree from the University of California, Berkeley, in political science in 2000, after which he spent 4 years working at the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, working on redistricting in California, Texas, and Illinois, including extensive participation in the California statewide Los Angeles City Council and Los Angeles Unified School District Board of Education redistricting processes. Our moderator, who will be very shortly, is here right now. Kathy Fung is the Executive Director of California Common Cause. And under her leadership, California Cause has taken leading role in election and redistricting reform, government sunshine and accountability laws, campaign finance reform, media access, and championing the voting rights of traditionally disenfranchised communities. Prior to joining Common Cause, Fung was a project director of voting rights and hate crimes at the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, APALC, where she worked in a variety of civil rights areas, including voting rights and redistricting, hate crimes, police accountability, and anti-discrimination law. She is currently the president of the LA County Human Relations Commission. She serves or has served on the Asian Pacific Policy and Planning Council Board, the California Secretary of State's Advisory Committee on Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, and on voter participation and outreach, the California Common Cause Board, LA County's Community Voter Outreach Committee, and a founder, and the LA County Human Relations Commission, the LAPD Police Chiefs API Forum, the Asian Pacific American Pacific Police Advisory Council, OCA, and the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. And other than that, she doesn't do much. Kathy graduated from Cornell University and received her JD from UCLA School of Law. And I would now like to turn this over to Kathy. Thank you.
Thank you, Phyllis. I just want to welcome everybody on behalf of the three organizations that are convening today's Town Hall Forum on Redistricting: California Common Cause, the League of Women Voters of Long Beach, and Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform Project. We're so pleased to be able to televise this and also record this for radio, and welcome everybody to today's important Town Hall Forum. Our first speaker is the Honorable Alan Lowenthal, who has represented Long Beach and the South Bay area for over 7 years. He is the co-author of SCA 3, which is the bill that currently is winding its way through the legislature to propose redistricting reform. And he'll have much to talk about, especially by way of what's been happening in the last week, as the legislature maneuvers to try to either pass a substitute reform or maybe ding the entire proposal. Before we begin, I would just like to mention that Senator Alan Lowenthal is also a movie actor, and maybe you didn't realize this, but he recently had a cameo role in the new movie Who Killed the Electric Car, which I was thinking about as I fought through the traffic to try to get here today. So let's start with Senator Alan Lowenthal. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Kathy.
So help us understand first how the redistricting process works currently.
Well, currently the way the redistricting process works is that every 10 years we have the census data is presented on the next one being in 2010. We had the last census in 2000, and that data is presented to the legislature. The legislature is responsible for drawing the district lines for the congressional seats. That is not done by the Congress. That is done by each of the state legislatures. And it also draws the lines for the state Senate, the state assembly, and also the Board of Equalization. When I was in 2001 is when we actually did the last redistricting in California, and I was in the assembly. The assembly actually was responsible for drawing its own lines and the lines of the Board of Equalization. The state Senate did the state Senate's lines and the congressional lines, and then we both voted on all the four lines, the congressional, Senate, assembly, and Board of Equalization, and that's how it's done.
So you've proposed a bill, and it's called SCA 3, Senate Constitutional Amendment 3, and it would propose to entirely revamp the way that redistricting is currently done. Give us some of the broad outlines of how it would change the way that the power to draw maps is currently meted out, and what would the new body that has the role of drawing the maps be required to do?
Well, the first thing is, you know, it's interesting. I used to sit down there on the city council from 1992 to 1998, and then I was elected to the State Assembly. And while I was on the City Council and also on in 1995-96, we drew the lines for the City Council, nine council districts, and then in 2001, we did for the State Assembly, State Legislature, and State Senate, congressional seats, and so forth. I will tell you, that has been the most political of all the activities that we've done. While we were to follow and did follow the Voting Rights Act and to follow certain criteria, it was my experience, and this is why I'm telling from my own personal experience why I got involved in this, first at the City Council level and then even more so in the state legislature. At the end of the day, when lines were drawn, even though we tried to follow some kind of process, since we were drawing our own lines, it seemed to me that what was happening was, rather than trying to serve communities of interest, our own self-interest, districts, legislators' own self-interest began to become preeminent. That is, at the end of the day, in order to get the votes, people will say, well, I would support this, but I really need this part of the, you know, to that community to make sure that my seat will be safer or that I'll be able to win in the next election and so forth. So I found it a very distasteful process and believe that and that really this was taking place at the same time that I perceived that there was really a tremendous distrust in the legislature itself. People began to feel that the legislative process was such that they didn't trust us. They felt like we were, again, only interested in our own self-interest or protecting incumbency. And so I began to think about how could this be done in a different way? And I joined a group of legislators in the Assembly. There were five Democrats and five Republicans, and we set up what was called the Bipartisan Caucus. And we said, well, you know, let's look at how the rest of the nation, what are the alternatives to the legislature drawing the boundaries? What other options do we have? And so we began to talk to different institutes. We brought in as an advisor to our group, the bipartisan group, Bruce Kane from the University of California, Political Science Department, to advise us on what were some of the options. And we began to look at how other states had done it. We began to see that in some states, and even in California, when they could not reach a consensus in the legislature, sometimes they had judges do it, sometimes they had independent commissions do it. And so we began to focus in on what would an independent commission, that is, rather than having the legislature draw its own lines and draw the lines of the congressional districts, what would occur, what would it look like if we defined what the criteria were, as we normally do but sometimes it's very hard for us to follow ourselves because our own self-interest sometimes get in the way. But what would it look like if we define a set of criteria and we had an independent citizens commission go around the state following those criteria and actually draw lines then become a process which would be self-executing. It would not have to come back to the legislature for our approval. So that began us, and that was really the genesis of SCA 3. When I was elected to the state senate in 2004, this was the first bill I put in across the desk, and so that was in December of 2004. So it's taken me really 2 years to really get it heard and to really get it before the legislature, and that will be coming up, and I'll describe that later. And it's really an independent commission, and I can tell you about how it's what's on it and the details, but the differences really are that this commission will follow this set of criteria and will draw the lines for the state.
You're listening to the Town Hall on Redistricting Reform, and we are speaking with Senator Lowenthal, one of the two authors of SCA 3, the other author being Senator Ashburn. Senator Lowenthal, tell us a little bit more about the commission that would be created. Just recently, we had on the ballot Proposition 77, which would have proposed a three-person all-judge panel, and it was soundly rejected by voters. What does SCA 3 propose that's so different?
Well, one of the differences between SCA 3 and Proposition 77 was a number of things. One was that the makeup of who drew the lines. Prop 77 said it would be done by three judges. SCA 3 really talks about a process by which judges would solicit recommendations, would solicit applications, and then submit a list of 55 names, 20 Democrats, 20 Republicans, and 15 independents of citizens who are distant from the legislature, who it really excludes a certain number of people who could even apply for that. It's anyone who has any kind of conflict of interest or relationship with the legislature. And these 55 citizens would be the pool on which an 11-member commission would be appointed. So already the differences would be an independent commission of citizens versus judges. These commission would reflect the diversity of the state. One of the problems that the legislature did not like about the Prop 77 was that the most likely that they would the three-member judges would not really reflect both the gender and ethnic distribution of the state in any way. This would be more likely that we would have people drawing lines that would really be able to listen to the constituencies out there. Another difference is that Proposition 77 called for mid-decade redistricting. Well, SCA 3 says, no, we redistrict at the time of the census. We're not really trying to make this a very political process. Mid-decade could become very political. Whenever one party who's in power wants to redistrict, it would allow you to do that. We do not want to make this. Actually, our goal is to depoliticize it, not to make it even more political. And so SCA 3 does not call for mid-decade or redistricting as Prop 77 did at any particular, whenever it's desired. Next thing is, Prop 77 said that once these judges had drawn lines, then the legislature could comment upon them and give input. On ours, we're trying to keep the legislature at an arm's length distance. And the next thing was Prop 77 said that there would be an election after whether the public would either support or not support these lines. And again, we felt that that would create possibly a never-ending cycle of consultants, people checking, having large elections. If we're going to go with an independent redistricting commission, we wanted it to be really separate from the political process. And so SCA 3 is self-executing. That is, once the commission makes a decision, that's final. It can be challenged in court, and that challenge can go to the Supreme Court in a very short time to see whether, in fact, they follow the criteria that was set for them. But it would be depoliticized, and so that's really the difference. One is a highly political process, and SCA 3 is one that depoliticized. It was based upon the Arizona model. We've looked at models throughout the country. We've strengthened it by talking to people from Arizona, talking from representatives from other states, and find that the model that SCA 3 has probably been the most vetted of any independent redistricting, independent commission in the nation, and builds upon the strengths of some of the others, but probably is even a stronger model than we've seen anywhere else in the nation.
Thank you, Senator Lowenthal. And just one last question, because I know that if anybody has been reading the papers lately, they have seen that there has been a lot of action in both the Senate and Assembly around different schemes to impact on redistricting reform, but also link it possibly to other types of governmental reforms like term limits reforms. Tell us what the latest is in the legislature and what people should expect to see.
Well, it's changing as we speak very momentarily. I think that what is occurring, there are a number of things that are occurring. We're about to end our legislative session at the end of August. So frequently in the legislature, lots of things occur late in the year. And so that's the first process, structural thing that's occurring. So while SCA 3 has been in print, it's gone through a number of amendments for now almost 2 years. It's been vetted. It's gone through a committee process. It's taken a number of amendments. It's now ready to be voted on and actually will be voted on by the Senate this coming Monday. It stands an excellent chance of getting out of the Senate because Senate leadership has already stated that they would like to see the legislature put out a redistrict in an independent commission. And if it comes out of the Senate, it will be then sent immediately to the Assembly. And there, the Assembly leadership has already said that they will look at it, and they, too, are committed to getting something out. So it's about to come to the end, and it's about to really be voted up or down. At the same time that we're talking about redistricting, there are other kinds of, as Kathy mentioned, reforms that are possible to tie to a reform package, and one of them is to look at term limits. Now, term limits reform is one that's not been very popular with the voters, even though there are some real problems with the way we have term limits at this point. And so some folks have said, well, why not combine the two now? Why not set up a commission that could make decisions about doing redistricting and term limits, and why not we tie those two together? Well, I think it'd be really good, I personally, and so there's now a conference committee to look at whether, how do we deal with both term limits and redistricting. As I've already said, redistricting will be voted up or down. I think it's going to get out. I think it should stand on its own merits. If it's a good proposal, it should be voted up. If people do not want to vote for it, let them be on the public record as not voting for it. I also think that if people want to do term limits, that should be a separate initiative, and we should have that also. I have no problem with that. I think now we're going to be looking at trying to link term limits to redistricting. I think that's the end of redistricting. I think that you're never going to get an independent commission that's linked together. People are going to see that they're linked together in that way. So I think that what we should be doing is looking at government reform. I like the idea of term limits reform also, but I think they should be separate initiatives and let the people decide if they want to pass a package, but let them be separate the way we do other things. I don't think it's a good idea to combine them, but that will be decided by a conference committee this coming week.
Thank you, Senator Lowenthal. You are listening to the Town Hall on Redistricting Reform. This is Kathy Fung with California Common Cause. I'm moderating a panel where we have four distinguished speakers. Our next speaker is Doug Johnson, who is with the Rose Institute's state and local government at Claremont McKenna College. Doug brings a lot of experience, not only consulting on the redistricting process in California, but also doing similar types of consulting in other states like Florida and Arizona. So we'll be able to talk a little bit about comparisons with what happens here and what happens in other states, what works, what doesn't, how can we learn some lessons from around the country. But to start with, Doug, I wanted to ask you a little bit of a historical perspective. Redistricting happens every 10 years, or at least that's what's supposed to happen, every 10 years after the census. And in different years, different bodies have drawn the maps for California. So in the 1990s, the whole process couldn't be agreed upon between the governor and the legislature, so it got kicked over to the courts. In 2001, the legislature drew the maps. Give us a little bit of a history lesson on what the difference is, why that happens, and how the maps are different depending on who draws them.
Sure. It's been an interesting experience in kind of what we call the modern redistricting era in California. This era is considered to start in the 60s when the Supreme Court said the districts had to be even in population. Before that, California state senate districts in particular were by counties. So LA County had one, and a rural county, or a couple of rural counties had one, and essentially they were, the LA County district was often 20 times the size of some of the smaller ones. That all ended in the 60s and brought us to where we are today, of essentially balanced districts. But what we've seen in California is balanced districts does not mean fair districts. We've had really two different approaches. In the 70s and the 90s, the governor, in the 70s Ronald Reagan, in the 90s Pete Wilson, vetoed the plans that were drawn by the legislature, and it all went to the courts. And in both times, the courts kind of said, okay, the legislative process is a bunch of political mumbo-jumbo. We're going to ignore all that and draw our own plans based on the communities of California. And we ended up with districts drawn for communities that were compact, that didn't split cities, and that swung with the mood of the voters. In the 70s, the Republicans actually were a big advocate of going to court, and right away it bit them in the rear because the plan was drawn and Watergate hit. And the districts were fair, they were competitive, and they reflected the voters, and the Republicans got creamed. But then through the rest of the decade, as you know, Prop 13 hit and the Reagan Revolution sort of kicked off, the Republicans took back a lot of those seats. So the districts were fair. They swung with the mood of the California voters. In the 90s, a similar thing took place. Again, the governor vetoed a plan drawn by the legislature. The court, actually using the same staff that they'd used in the 70s, drew another community-oriented kind of fair plan. And they also swung with the mood of the voters. In 94, with the Republican Revolution in D.C., California also elected a bunch of new Republicans. And the Republicans actually took a majority of the Assembly in 94, briefly. So it was a big Republican surge, just like the voter trend was. And then by 2000, the state's voters had swung much more to the Democrats, and the Democrats picked up a lot more seats. The 80s and our current plan were a very different story. In 81... Democrats controlled the legislature and the governor's office, and they passed a very partisan plan, essentially California's predecessor to the Tom DeLay Texas debacle. It was a very partisan plan. It took effect. It wiped out five incumbent Republicans, and the voters threw it out. And they passed a referendum. And actually, Jerry Brown was then governor, and the last bill he signed was redrawing a new plan. The problem is the voters threw out the plan, but they didn't put in a commission. They let the legislature draw it again, and of course the legislature drew a bad plan again. This time it was bipartisan, though, because the incumbent Republicans didn't want to get back their seats. They just wanted to protect themselves. And so that plan essentially had no change. The difference, though, between then and now is that the computers, the data, the expertise wasn't as sophisticated. So even then, there were districts that flipped hands every so often. Today, nothing changes. In 2004, we saw 153 elections, not a single district change hands. We're probably going to see the same thing this year. That's the first time in California's history that nothing has changed, and that's the extreme nature. And those of you in the audience can see the districts drawn up here and just how crazy they are, especially here in Long Beach, where we have districts along the beach, districts through the middle, and districts across the top, cutting us every which way.
Mm-hmm. And the 2001 process that you were just describing, where the maps have resulted in districts that do not change hands and essentially where there's no competition, those maps were drawn by who?
They were drawn by the legislature, by staff in a closed back room. They did hold public hearings, but they were a bit of a sham. The staff were always in the back with a secret plan that, of course, they swapped out at the very end. Mm-hmm.
You've been an expert in redistricting and consulted with several other states, including Florida and Arizona. Tell us a little bit about how the Arizona process works. They have a commission, and certainly SCA 3, the bill on redistricting reform, proposes something very similar to Arizona's structure. What's been your experience in Arizona?
It's been amazing. The contrast between the legislature's approach of kind of sham hearings and what happened in Arizona, where they actually held 57 public hearings in a state that is one-fifth the size of California. They held 57 hearings. One thing that was said a lot about Arizona is that, and it's said in opposition to reform here, is that redistricting is inherently political. Well, the results of redistricting do have political impact. The question is whether that is just a result or whether it controls the process. And Arizona is a great case. We actually had a great article where a reporter wrote about all the political party guys who were out in the hallway desperately trying to follow and influence the process. Well, that was the difference. The party guys were outside trying to find a way to influence the process while the public was in the meeting, actually giving input, and the city leaders and the community leaders were actually seeing the maps change to reflect their desires, as opposed to when the legislature draws it, where the campaign managers and the party leaders are in the back room controlling everything and the public is essentially shut out.
Doug Johnson with Claremont McKenna College's Rose Institute on State and Local Government. Tell us a little bit about what it is that people come to these hearings to testify about when the Arizona Commission was convened.
They talk about neighborhoods, communities, redistricting when it's done right, as it was in Arizona, as it was in California by the courts, can be enabling for community involvement. If communities are the basis of districts, well, you have local activists that get involved in school district races. You have activists that then, you know, they find influence, they gather people who agree with them, and then they can step up and support, you know, city races. And they kind of grow, and the districts enable that by building on cities and counties and state legislative districts and then up to congressional districts. And that allows the locals to get active and to grow their circles of influence. If it's done badly, then the lines cut through. When you have, you know, your group that's organized around the school district, well, if the line cuts through the middle of your school district, half of your activists can't get involved in the next race up. Mm-hmm. We saw this in Downey in 81. Little Downey was cut between three or four congressional districts. The local organizations, you know, one-third of the members would be in one district, one-third in another. They had no say and no ability to organize and influence elections. That was just wrong. And we see that here where the, you know, the coastal piece is split off in a district that's Rancho Palos Verdes and Orange County. It splits through the communities, splits up people's ability to get organized, and of course people get cynical and turn off.
You're listening and watching the Town Hall on Redistricting Reform, and we are here with four panelists to help us understand a little bit about redistricting, how it works, and what some of the proposals for reform are. Our next speaker is Steve Ochoa, who currently directs the voting rights and policy research for the William C. Velasquez Institute. He brings a lot of experience in redistricting, especially when it comes to holding the mouse and drawing the actual lines, sitting in front of the computer, listening to testimony, and trying to incorporate all of that testimony into a proposed plan. In the 2001 process, Steve Ochoa worked on behalf of the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, or MALDEF, and helped create plans on behalf of minority communities to present to the legislature. Steve, welcome today.
Thank you very much.
So, given all the experience that you've had, tell us, you know, when you compare the district maps that are drawn and you look at the 2001 maps compared to those in 1991, you can clearly see a big difference. And we have circulated some maps to the audience where you can see the difference between 1991 for the congressional districts and compare those that were drawn for the Senate as well as the Assembly. The maps in 2001 are very squiggly. You might even say that they're doing enormous acrobatic tricks in order to bend over each other and fit. And in 1991, they seem to be a little bit more compact and less gerrymandering. Tell us why the difference in the two sets of maps.
Well, I would say the one great good thing that came out of the 2001 redistricting is it really helped my psychological profile because I suddenly was looking at Rorschach test plots all over the place now. So, in short, Senator Lowenthal described the 2001 process as distasteful. But before that distasteful part happened, there was one great kumbaya moment in that all the party leaders got together and they basically agreed we're going to keep the numerical partisan breakdown of the state Senate, the state assembly, and the U.S. Congress congressional delegation the same number. So and they did that in the spirit of they didn't want an ugly partisan battle, and it was a gentleman's agreement, so they didn't have to sue each other if this one party or the other lost a few seats. But right immediately after that, that sign of bipartisanship, basically what happened is each party drew the districts that they controlled. And when that happens is, so first, so once that happened, basically the incumbent's natural desire to make their ease of re-election does kind of kick in. And so what happens is, so Democrats started drawing their districts with a focus on shoring up their not-so-safe seats. Republicans did the same. And what happened is you had all these extra tentacles, indentations, and that was a major part in why the lines are the way they are today. I can give a few examples just on the congressional level. I can name at least three congressional districts in the 2000 election. Adam Schiff, based out of the Burbank area. Jane Harman, based out of the Torrance area. Alan Tauscher in the Contra Costa Bay area. Those were some of the most competitive districts in the nation, and both parties put in a lot of money. And after redistricting, completely safe. Not much news out of there. So that was the big part, that there was an agreement, and then they started drawing their own. A few other things shaped how districts moved. Senator Lowenthal described how that after every 10 years, districts had to be reset kind of back to equal population. And that basically meant some areas of the state which grew proportionally to the others had to shrink in size to lose population. And some areas like the urban areas like Los Angeles, those districts had to expand. So that also played a part. And one last thing that kind of played into it was basically following redistricting law. But because of such of the partisan interest, things like respecting communities of interest, the Voting Rights Act, the legislature basically tried to do the bare minimum so they could muster support or pass the courts. And, you know, but basically it still resulted because of the incumbency factors and shoring up elections that led to all these crazy lines you see before you now.
You are listening to the Town Hall on Redistricting Reform. Steve Ochoa from the William C. Velasquez Institute has just described to us how in 2001 the legislature colluded, the two parties colluded to create safe seats for each other, and did the bare minimum to protect the Voting Rights Act and preserve communities of interest when they were drawing the lines. One of the very striking examples, and one of the reasons why we're here today in the city of Long Beach, is that when the new lines got drawn for Long Beach ended up being sliced and diced more ways than a pizza pie. Describe for us, especially for those folks who may be watching on television or listening in on the radio, how it is that Long Beach ended up getting so split up, and what some of the political motivations might have been that resulted in those gerrymandered lines.
There are two primary reasons why Long Beach was cut up a lot. One, there was a real focus this time in this redistricting process to maintain city boundaries, maintain city integrities as much as possible. But what happens with a large city such as Los Angeles City and Long Beach is that their populations are so big that they have to be cut anyways to maintain equal population balances in multiple districts. So what often happens is, first, you know, since a map drawer will see that Long Beach and say, well, it's already cut up anyways, what's the matter? We can cut it up a little bit more. You know, that's when, you know, it was one of the areas where map drawers would play with balancing equal population down to the one-person level. A few other aspects that played into Long Beach where incumbents were. If you look at the state Senate seat, which is one of my favorite examples of partisan gerrymandering, and not necessarily at Long Beach first per se, but you'll notice that Senate District 25 starts out in the South Central Los Angeles area, the African American core, snakes through Northern Long Beach, goes down to a tiny sliver around San Pedro, and to put Palos Verdes in with South Central Los Angeles. I mean, it's perfect communities of interest. I mean, I can't argue with that. But you know, also because then Assemblywoman Jenny Oropesa was representing the 55th Assembly seat, which was at that point nested in the 28th Senate seat. At some point, you know, she was looking to run for that seat, and she did. So that part of that snake kind of goes around her neighborhood to make sure to keep her in the district. So I mean, there are future political considerations when you're drawing these maps, as in like as from they were thinking about this year's elections back then. But that led to a few more cuts for your city.
Thank you, Steve. I understand that Senator Lowenthal has a few more insights on what happened in Long Beach and wants to share with us.
Yeah.
We're getting some good stuff today.
You are getting some good stuff today. And again, I have to preface this by saying it's my perception of what took place in watching all this, and I'm really following up on Steve, that decisions about redistricting took place far from California, because we've really talked about just the state legislature and much. But as Steve pointed out, that the attempt to maintain the balance really was decisions that were made in Washington, D.C., between the both national parties. And they decided that with the new census coming out in 2001, when California was decided that it would gain one seat in the census, the question was, how do you keep that balance between what was already the existing number of Republicans who were going to, and the existing number of Democrats, and add one additional seat? And what really took place, I'm a psychologist, and I will tell you, what really took place was social Darwinism. That is, the strong got stronger and the weak got weaker. And we here in Long Beach had an independent, maverick, Republican congressperson, Congressmember Horn. Now, he's a member of the other party, and so I'm still going to try to defeat him, but I thought that what took place to Congressman Horn in drawing the boundaries, I would rather win or lose at the ballot box, not because of what took place. And what took place was that seat, which was primarily a Long Beach seat, was decided by both parties, because he was not in the mainstream in either party, was going to be given up. And so the Republicans gave up that seat and said, we'll take a seat in Fresno, where we need to grow, which is much more. And the Democrats said, we'll take a new seat, that the new additional seat that's going to come in to California. And that resulted in drawing lines to protect everything else, because we were cut out, our community of interest, and I was at those meetings and testified against it and voted against it. Had nothing to do with what the needs of Long Beach were. It had to do with what the needs of both national parties were. And that's what was so distasteful about the process.
If I may add one thing to Senator Lowenthal's description of former Congressman Horn's district.
You're listening to Steve Ochoa.
Thank you, Kathy. The state legislature also used that congressional seat became Linda Sanchez's seat. So that was also their one voting rights consideration. That became a new Latino congressional member. And that's when I was mentioning the bare minimums. One of the bare minimums is following the Voting Rights Act. And generally speaking, what it says is if a minority group gets sufficiently large enough to support two districts, you usually have to draw it. And this was a way to draw. They also used the voting rights as an excuse to sort of sacrifice a competitive Republican seat. They gave the Republicans a solid seat in Tulare County, and then they used it to make a favored Latina Democrat a seat as well. So there were other considerations as well. I should point out that the Maldiv and the William C. Velasquez Institute also did try to turn Congressman Horns into a Latino seat, but in a lot more compact manner and a little more respect to North Long Beach.
You are listening to the Town Hall Forum on Redistricting Reform, and our last speaker is Lori Lofstrom. Lori is active in the Long Beach Chamber of Commerce. She's the vice chair of the Public Policy Committee, and she also chairs the Government Affairs Council. Lori, you bring a unique perspective because you're actually from Long Beach and you're very active here, you work with the Long Beach Chamber of Commerce, which has just recently decided to endorse SCA3. Tell us why you made that decision.
It's a good bill. I first want to thank you for inviting me to be here on behalf of the chamber. And we're excited to support this bill and Senator Lowenthal on this bill. We think it's about time that someone took this issue, you know, to heart and really did something positive with it. So it's easy, I think, for the business community in Long Beach to get behind this bill and, support those here tonight. It's a fair bill, and it's something that's needed rectified for a number of years. I think all the communities in Long Beach and California have seen that this has been a problem and have seen our legislature in California basically dysfunctional because of it. There's so many stalemates in Sacramento because of this that clearly something needed to be done. So it's something we're pleased to get behind and support.
Thank you. We now want to segue over to our questions from the audience, and I know that we are collecting question cards from the audience, and many of them focus on wanting to know a lot more about what's happening with SCA3 in the legislature and what the prospects are. So let me pose this question first to Senator Lowenthal. If SCA3 is passed by the Senate and the Assembly, what happens to it then? Does it automatically go into effect?
No, we're talking about that. This is what is so historic about SCA3, in that when there's been major changes in other states towards either judicial or independent citizens commissions, usually it comes from the initiative process that has been generated by citizens' petitions. You know, we have here in California our initiative process, and usually it's an attempt by people who say, well, the legislature's not doing their business, or that there's real, I can go directly to the public, you gather signatures, and you put something on. For a legislature to voluntarily vote to put on the ballot, because that's the second way you can do an initiative, to change California law, the Constitution, in terms of how we draw our boundaries, takes a vote of the people of California. What's unique about SCA3 and what is historic about it is that it would be a legislature voluntarily putting on the ballot a giving up of its own power. That has never, to the extent, ever happened before. So the question is this legislature going to voluntarily do that, and what's the likelihood? And I will tell you, there's a really good chance that it might do that this year. Why? One, when the legislature was fighting against Prop 77, the leadership on both sides said, we'll come up with our own and put it before the voters. So that, you know, there's a commitment there on the part of the leadership to put this on the ballot. Two, both leaders, both the governor, both Mr. Angelides, and others are also calling for this. And I think that the time is right for everyone coming together and saying, let's put this on the ballot. So I think that I've been shocked that how many legislators are ready to do it. Now, the longer we wait, to the 2010 census, the less likely we are to do it. This is about the last year that the legislature could do it, because these folks, there's still going to be a six-year time before the new lines are drawn in 2012. So they can vote on it this year, but if we don't get it out this year, it's highly unlikely that in the future years that they're going to be able, it will come from the legislature, because it's going to be too difficult for legislators to vote on it, because it's going to impact them. Right now they think, well, it's just going to impact the next group that comes along. And so we can use that to our advantage. So that's what's so unusual about what's taking place now, and why we may actually get it. And I think that there's more than a 50-50 chance that we're going to get it out of the legislature.
And if the legislature gets a bill passed by two-thirds vote and places it on the November 2006 ballot for voters to vote on, what are the prospects? Doug, I think you recently were involved in a poll.
We were, actually. The Rose Institute, together with Common Cause and the League of Women Voters, did a poll right after Prop 77 was defeated, where essentially we asked the voters, okay, 60% or so voted no on 77, but did you vote no because you opposed reform or because just 77 wasn't the right reform? And when you put the numbers together, it turns out two-thirds of California voters support redistricting reform. Obviously, majority thought 77 was the wrong reform, but there's a solid majority. It's almost as strong as support for term limits, ironically. But the public is clearly supportive. The challenge is that the public doesn't engage. You know, it's great to be here in Long Beach. We've had, you know, kind of the victims of redistricting over and over again, kind of the champion of reform here next to me, who's I talked about, you know, going up from lower levels and building your organization and getting promoted, essentially, because people like what you're doing, and the senator's a great example of that. But Long Beach is fairly unique in having both a legislature that really cares and people, those of you here tonight, those of you watching, who really care. The challenge is to engage the public so they don't fall for sham ads and that they really look at the issue and see what's needed here and realize that SEA 3 is the right reform, and let's pass this thing, because short of some, you know, crazy ad campaign that distracts everybody again, the voters are there.
You are listening to the town hall on redistricting reform, and we are going through audience questions and answers. A number of audience members have asked about communities of interest. We've heard this term tossed around a little bit, and want to know how redistricting reform will do anything differently to ensure that communities of interest or local jurisdictions like school districts might be considered with greater attention than if the legislature were to draw the maps. And I'm opening this question up to anyone on the panel. Doug Johnson.
Let me start, and then obviously there's others with comments on this too. I think communities are the key. And in California in particular, when you say communities of interest, the focus is on ethnic minority communities. But that's really because they have a legal stick. And so they get a seat at the table through the Voting Rights Act. But it's equally true of every community. Long Beach, a city, is a community, has the right to have one representative, at most two representatives. You know, being split up three and four ways is just absurd, and it takes away your voice, and that hurts the city. You know, the great thing in the 90s, Long Beach faced big challenges with the naval shipyard closing, lots of defense spending dropping, and because of the fair districts that were oriented around Long Beach, the city was able to get organized, get a good voice in Sacramento that brought aid and assistance here, get a strong voice in D.C. If Long Beach were to face something like that now, you'd never get the representation and the high priority that we were able to get with the good fair districts. So I think every community has a stake in this, and fair districts enable communities. Unfair districts enable the incumbents. So.
A number of questions also about the representation of minority populations. So I'm going to ask Steve Ochoa from the Willie Velasquez Institute, to tell us a little bit, I guess to back us up a little bit, and tell us, in the 2001 redistricting process, you worked with MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and you proposed very different maps for how Southern California's districts might look, and in particular, what might have happened for Long Beach. Would you describe those maps?
So one of the process MALDEF undertook when it was preparing its maps in 2001 was we knew the strongest maps would have the most thought in it, and frankly, have the best ear of the people. We went up and down the state, admittedly focusing in the minority Latino communities, but we held about 20 public workshops to go and listen to people and ask them, all right, what are your neighborhoods? What do you think absolutely should be kept together? Who do you relate to? And we took that information, that qualitative information, and we put that into our map, and we focused, try to keep people together as much as we could. There's certain demographic shifts at some point. Cuts will have to happen at some point, but if you at least try to listen to as many people as possible, you make a good faith effort to be inclusive, and the minority community does have more of a legal stick as well. So, I mean, that does help our community out. But, I mean, if you do that process, it would help out Long Beach and other cities that were cut up. So we went and proposed. We focused on communities of interest, minorities. Are they minority? Are they have the same income bracket, education levels? What binds them together? And then we try to focus. If you're going to make a cut, keep cities together as much. If a city had to be cut, do it along straight, lines that kind of make sense. If I went up to you and says, all right, the district line goes up to Cherry Avenue, you would at least know rather than, it goes down the back alley for a little bit and then turns on, 53rd Street. That brings a sense of at least, community to the public to know, where at least your districts are if you can explain them easily.
And the proposal that MALDEF put forward would have impacted Long Beach how?
On the congressional level, Long Beach, at the very least, is usually going to be cut into two districts. And on our, we also did convert Congressman Horns into a minority seat based out of the Southgate Linwood area and encompassing North Long Beach. Long Beach had to be cut, but at least, North Long Beach kind of related to Linwood and Southgate. At least it made sense. Now Long Beach, say on the congressional level, you're in the middle with Rancho Palos Verdes and Newport Beach. And in some areas, the line is along the sand to go around San Pedro. Because those are Democratic minority voters that had to be saved for other districts, not the Republican district. I believe it's Dana Roybacher now.
I think some commentators have commented that at high tide, you actually have a disconnected district, and at low tide, you've got a connected district.
There's a way, if Long Beach has to be cut, there are ways to do it respectfully at the very least that, if done with your input, and then coming back to you and saying, all right, this is the best we could do. We took in this reason, that reason. At the very least, the public would kind of at least see, okay, we understand. Thank you for at least telling us why.
And Steve Ochoa, MALDEF eventually ended up suing and challenging the 2001 congressional lines. Give us a quick snapshot of why.
Yes, we were involved in a pretty big lawsuit. It was called Cano v. Davis. And there were three districts that we were focusing on. Congressional districts in the San Fernando Valley, a congressional district in San Diego, and a state senate seat in based out of Long Beach and the southeast cities. One of the backstory is on the state senate side. For the state senate, the map drawer who was in charge of drawing both the state congressional and the state senate was Michael Berman, who happened to be the brother of Congressman Howard Berman, who resided in the eastern San Fernando Valley. In the 1990s, that district was square, compact, and actually had grown into a very close to a cohesive, not a Latino community. And to ensure that Howard Berman wasn't discomforted in a possible primary election. Some Latinos were removed from his district, and some non-Latinos were added, and they put a limit on what the Latino registration could be in various instances.
Thank you. So the follow-up question is to Senator Lowenthal. What will the commission do that's so different that might preserve minority interests or protect the Voting Rights Act's enforcement?
Well, let me preface again by saying, kind of from George Orwell, you know, all animals are equal, only some are more equal than others. That's the way it's been. You know, we set up in the legislature, and I have a great, first let me say, I have great belief in the legislature. I like being in the legislature. I think we do great work when we're legislating. I think we don't do great work when we're drawing our own boundaries. That's really what the issue is. And I think what happened is that we tried to follow the Voting Rights Act. We tried to follow communities of interest. But as was pointed out, at the end of the day, the decisions were not made in public, and the decisions were made to protect the incumbency, and it was a deal cut by both parties. And so everybody was involved, except a few legislators that voted against this. I think what we're talking about is, as long as we can ensure that the panel really and the selection process really reflects California, as long as we can make sure that we really follow the Voting Rights Act and not just say, as Steve pointed out, we do the minimal amount, but we use that as our highest criteria in going through the process, as long as we have public hearings, as long as nothing can be done in secret, as long as everything must be published, everything, and that we go around, as Doug pointed out, and have a series of meetings to define what are those communities of interest, the communities involved in the process, then we'll draw the best lines that we can. Are we going to have everything perfect? No. But is it going to be the best that we can do? Yes. And it'll be a step forward anyway. And that's really what I'm really trying to propose, that we move forward. I'm not saying that this is a panacea and everybody's going to be satisfied. I am saying that it elevates the status of fairness and it really has us follow a set of rules and that at least we all know what the rules are.
Lori Lofstrom, you're with the Chamber of Commerce, and you've got you've developed a position of support for SCA 3. Tell us why you think that local communities, local community organizations, and local chambers of commerce have come around to start supporting something as radical as the idea of redistricting reform.
Well, I think that probably everybody in this room and you know most Californians by the polls seem to indicate that something has to be done, and there's a clear need, and this answers that need. You know, putting the redistricting in the hands of an independent commission seems to satisfy that need in a fair, equitable way. Using certain criteria, everybody's going to use the same criteria. You know, that sounds pretty fair to people. I think it also makes for a greater deal of accountability and self-control in terms of the legislators themselves. Creates some checks and balances. I think that sounds like a real positive step. So I think those are some of the reasons that it sounds like a real good proposal.
This is the town hall on redistricting reform, and we're here in the city of Long Beach talking about the current redistricting process and its impact on Southern California neighborhoods. One of the questions that I want to pose to Senator Lowenthal and then give him a moment to also respond to Lori Lofstrom's comments is there is both growing support and some opposition to the notion of redistricting reform. Tell us right now who supports SCA 3. We've heard some surprising announcements from, for instance, the gubernatorial candidates.
Well, I think it's growing. I think that every day, I think that you have almost every newspaper in the state supports now, pretty much supports reform and an SEA 3. I think that you have both gubernatorial candidates supporting it. I think you have the leadership of the legislature, and each day more and more legislators are saying that they support it. So I think that's who supports it. Now, who opposes it? Many, many legislators who, you know, it's very difficult to give up power, who want to see it combined with other things, and I have a real problem with that. Not that I don't think that there needs to be other kinds of reforms, and I do support it, but by lumping it together, I think weakens the opportunity for us to really do redistricting reform. And so that's on the other side. But I would like to say there's one other dynamic that's going to take place this time that SEA 3 has a strength to that's never been done before in this state, but has been. I talked about its 11-person commission. Of this 11 persons on this independent commission, four of them are going to be Democrats, four of them are going to be Republicans, but three of them are going to be declined to states or independents, which are going to be the swing voters on this commission. I think it's crucially important for us to realize that the great change that's taken place in California has been the rise of the independent voter and the decline to states who have been cut out of this process. They will be part of this process. For example, I'll quickly describe this. In 1990, there were about 6.5 million Democrats and about 5.5 million Republicans and about a couple of hundred thousand people who were registered as independent or third party. By now, there's still about basically the same number of Democrats with all of our voting, you know, going out to enlist new voters, same number of Republicans, but there are now over 2.5 million declined to states. It is important that they have a voice also in this process because they are the new swing voters that go back and forth. And I think SEA 3 brings them also into the process. And I think that's crucially important as we move into the 21st century.
We're about to wrap up the town hall on redistricting reform. I want to give each speaker a chance to give some closing comments. And let's start with Lori Lostrom, Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you. I think that the chamber views this as an opportunity to work along with Senator Lowenthal to accomplish a real positive change for California and maybe get us moving along a little bit better, or hopefully a lot better. I think that, and I think it's been alluded to, that this is a bad situation right now that both parties are really responsible for. And I think it's really incumbent upon the members of each party now to come together and resolve it. And I think that's what the people want. And I think that more and more as the support grows is what the legislators are going to hear the people want. So I think that'll be a great solution.
Thank you, Lori. Steve Ochoa with the William C. Velasquez Institute, having worked so much to represent minority communities in the redistricting process, what are your closing comments?
The real key to any redistricting form, be it a commission or having the legislature still maintain drawing power, is transparency. The transparency Senator Lowenthal said it right. It was a sham in 2001. Hearings were late, quickly scheduled, short notice. I rarely saw notes taken. And
they were lucky that they stayed awake.
Yes, and really, they are all the drawing was almost probably already done at that point. We didn't see an effort to go and really hear what you had to say about your communities, about your districts. If your districts had to change, where should it go? That's the real reform that's needed. I'll give SCEA 3 its credit. It's built in a lot of hearings. It's trying to put in a lot of transparency, and it is light years better than Prop 77. With people like Kathy and Senator Lowenthal trying to work for the public good and your voice, to make sure you at least have the opportunity to be heard, it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Doug Johnson with Claremont McKenna College's Rose Institute. You've got a lot of experience looking at how redistricting is done around the country, comparing it to California's process. What are your closing comments?
I think redistricting ultimately is about representation and fairness. If it's done right, the districts represent communities, and as the voters' opinions change, the people elected change. When it's done wrong, as it was in 2001, it doesn't matter what the voters think. The incumbents and the party bosses have chosen who will be represented. I look at today's debate and say the Minutemen and the opponents of illegal immigration really sway the voters and get a hard right turnout. It won't change a single election. The party bosses and the incumbents have decided who wins. Say that the Latino registration movement registers a million new voters and has another big march like they did and really fires up the voters. It still won't change the results of a single election.
You're not alluding by any chance to District 50 in San Diego, are you?
I'm alluding to a whole bunch of districts.
Where Congressman Cunningham resigned in disgrace, but nonetheless there was little changeover in who controlled that district?
Oh, yeah. That's a great example. I mean, right here in Long Beach, it was interesting. As Steve and I in the center were talking about what changed here, in the 90s, none of us mentioned competitiveness. We all talked about the community orientation of the district. But in California, if you draw a district around communities, the voters also get what they're looking for in competitiveness. You don't have to gerrymander to get it. This was a highly competitive district. I see in the audience Connie Zeeple, who was Congressman Horn's district director when I was working for him, too. And, I mean, election season was miserable for us in his office. You know, we cakewalked one year with a 3% victory. It was always close. And that was because it was a community-oriented district, and it gave the voters a choice. And every year, Congressman Horn had to go out and revalidate himself with the voters and reprove himself. The new districts take that away. The incumbents cakewalk. They know who's going to win 2 years, 4 years, and 6 years away, and that's wrong. And redistricting should be about fairness. We need to fix it. SCA 3 would do it. Arizona proved that, and I think we can prove it here in California. It's not hopeless, but it's painful.
And our final, last but definitely not least speaker is Senator Alan Lowenthal, the author of SCA 3, champion of what used to be a losing cause but now seems to be gaining some momentum in both the Senate and the Assembly. I want you to give us closing comments but also to answer some questions that have been asked from the audience. If somebody likes the idea of independent redistricting reform, what can they do? How can they be heard?
You know, there are good ideas, and the timing is not right for those ideas, and they go down to defeat. This is not an idea that came from any one of us on this panel. There are many, many people before us who have said that we need a better process. The reason why we're here tonight is that we're at a critical junction. We really have, because of a lot of other things that have taken place, an opportunity to bring this to fruition, to really make this change right now, because we have a bipartisan support beginning to build for this. Redistricting will only occur in this state is if we all kind of hold hands. We're not going to get everything that we want, but that we come together and say, let's do it now and not have some kind of both parties fighting for it. I think what you need to do to answer Kathy's question is to first send it letters, email your senators, all the Senate. It is coming up in the state Senate on Monday. The state Senate, if you really believe in what we've been talking about and support it, tell your friends, vote for SCA 3. Tell those senators to vote for it on Monday. It will then be going immediately, if it gets out of the Senate, to the Assembly. We have an opportunity in the next week or two to really do something historic in California right now. If you believe in it, it's up to you. I've done as much as I can do. The people up here have done as much as they can do. This will pass, and Mark, if the people of California let their legislators know that they need to pass this, and we will pass it, and it'll be put on the ballot.
Thank you, Senator Lowenthal. This is the Town Hall on Redistricting Reform. Before we close, I just want to thank the City of Long Beach for generously allowing us to meet in their City Council chambers, and also to thank the co-sponsoring organizations, the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project, League of Women Voters Long Beach Area, and California Common Cause for hosting this event. Thank you to all of our panelists. Let's give them a warm round of applause.